You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Esoteric Christianity and the Mission of Christian Rosenkreuz. This is the second lecture given in Nuremberg, this one on the 3rd of December, 1911, numbered number 12, with the same title, Faith, Love, Hope, the Third Revelation to Mankind. Yesterday we tried to gain a conception of the importance in human life of what may be termed the supersensible revelation of our age. We indicated that this was to be regarded as the third revelation in the most recent cycle of mankind, and should, in a certain sense, be seen in sequence to the Sinai revelation and the revelation at the time of the mystery of Golgotha. We ought not to look upon this feature of our age as something affecting us merely theoretically or scientifically. As anthroposophists, we must rise to an ever fuller realization that we are neglecting something essential in our evolution if we hold aloof from all that is being revealed to us now and will be revealed in the future. It is quite fitting that the external world should at first pass this by, or even treat it as sheer fantasy, and quite natural also that many people should initially pay no attention to the harmful consequences of disregarding these things. But anthroposophists should be clear that the souls in human bodies today, irrespective of what they absorb at present, are working their way toward a quite particular future. What I shall have to say concerns every soul, for it is part of the whole trend of change in our time. The souls incarnated today have only recently advanced to that stage of genuine ego consciousness, which has been in preparation during the course of evolution ever since the ancient Atlantean period. But for the people of those ancient days, up to the time when the mystery of Golgotha intimated a great transformation, this ego consciousness was gradually freeing itself from a consciousness of which modern people no longer have any real knowledge. People of today generally distinguish only between our ordinary condition of being awake and the state of sleep, when consciousness is in complete abeyance. Between these states they recognize also the intermediate one of dreaming, but from the present-day perspective they can regard it only as a kind of aberration, a departure from the normal. Through dream pictures, certain events from the depths of soul life rise into consciousness. But in ordinary dreaming they emerge in such an obscure form that the dreamer is scarcely ever able properly to interpret their very real bearing on deep supersensible processes in his life of soul. In order to grasp one characteristic feature of this intermediate dreaming state, a state well understood in earlier times, let us take an ordinary dream which a modern scientific investigator of dreams, able to interpret it only superficially and in a materialistic way, has made into a regular riddle, a highly significant dream. You see, I am taking my example from the science of dreams, which, as I have mentioned before, has today been given a place, little understood though it is, among sciences such as chemistry and physics. The following dream, a characteristic one, has been recorded. I might easily have taken my example from similar unpublished dreams, but I would like to deal with one which raises certain problems for present-day commentators, who have no key to such matters. The case is as follows. A married couple had a much beloved son, who was the apple of their eye. One day he fell ill, and his condition worsened in a few hours so quickly that at the end of this one day he passed through the gate of death. Thus, to all outward appearance, this couple's son was abruptly snatched from them, and the son himself torn from a life full of promise. The parents naturally mourned their son. During the months following, there was a great deal in the dreams of both husband and wife to remind them of him. But quite a long time, many, many months after his death, there came a night when his father and mother had exactly the same dream. They dreamed that their son appeared to them, saying he had been buried alive, having only been in a trance, and that they merely had to look into the matter to be convinced that this was true. The parents told each other what they had dreamt on the same night, and such was their attitude to life that they immediately asked the authorities for permission to have their son's body disinterred. The request was refused, giving the parents further cause for grieving. Now the researcher who gave his account of the dream, and could think of it only in a materialistic way, was faced with great difficulties. He finally explained it in a remarkable way, which is bound to seem very contrived to anyone reading it. He said, "We can only assume that one parent had the dream and the other, hearing it when awake, got the idea that he or she had dreamt it also. To present-day consciousness, this interpretation at first seems fairly obvious, but it doesn't go very deep. I have expressly mentioned that for anyone well-versed in dream experiences, there is nothing unusual in several people having the same dream at the same time. Let us try now to look into this dream experience from the point of view of spiritual science. The results of spiritual investigation show how a person who has gone through the gate of death lives on as an individuality in the world of spirit. We know, too, that there are definite connections between everything and every being in the world, and that this is evident in the link that unites those who have departed with people still on earth, when the latter lovingly concentrate thoughts on their dead. There is no question of there not being a connection between those on the physical plane and those who have left it for the supersensible world. There is always a connection when those left on the physical plane turn their thoughts to the dead, a connection that may continue even when their thoughts are directed elsewhere. But the point is that human beings, organized as they are now for life on the physical plane, are unable to become conscious of these bonds when awake. Having no knowledge of a thing, however, does not justify denying its existence. That would be a very superficial conclusion. On that basis, those now sitting in this room and not seeing Nuremberg could easily prove there is no such place. So we must be clear that it is only because of their present-day organization that people know nothing of their connection with the dead. It exists all the same. However, knowledge of what is going on in the depths of the soul can occasionally be conjured up into consciousness, and this happens in dreams. It is one thing we have to reckon with when considering dream experiences. Another thing is the knowledge that passing through death is not the sudden leap imagined by those knowing nothing about it. It is a gradual transition. What occupies a soul here on earth does not vanish in a moment when we die. What we love, we continue to love after our death. But there is no possibility of satisfying a feeling which depends for its satisfaction on a physical body. The wishes and desires of the soul, its joys, sorrows, the particular tendencies it has during incarnation in a physical body, these naturally continue even when we have passed through the gate of death. We can therefore understand how strong was the feeling in that young man, meeting death quite unprepared, that he would like to be still on earth, and how keen was his longing to be in a physical body. This desire, working as a force in the soul, lasted for a long, long time during his Kamaloka. Now, vividly picture to yourselves the parents with their thoughts engrossed by their beloved dead son. Even in sleep, the connecting links were there. just at the moment when both father and mother began to dream, the son, in accordance with the state of his soul, had a particularly keen desire that we may perhaps clothe in these words, quote, "Oh, if only I were still on earth in a physical body," close quote. This thought on the part of the dead son sank deep into his parents' souls, but they had no special faculty for understanding what lay behind the dream. Thus the imprint of the thought in their life of soul was transformed into familiar images. If they could have clearly perceived what the son was pouring into their souls, their interpretation would have been, quote, "Our son is longing just now for a physical body," close quote. In fact, the dream image clothed itself in words they understood, quote, "He has been buried alive," close quote, which hid the truth from them. Thus, in dream pictures of this kind, we should not look for an exact replica of spiritual reality. We must expect the actual objective occurrence to be veiled in accordance with the dreamer's degree of understanding. Today, it is the peculiar feature of the dream world that if we are unable to go into these matters more deeply, we can no longer regard its pictures as faithful images of what underlies them. We are obliged to say that something always lives in our soul behind the dream image, and this image can be regarded only as a still greater illusion than the external world we see when we are awake. It is only in our time that dreams are appearing to people in this guise, strictly speaking, only since the events in Palestine, when ego consciousness took on the form it has now. Before then, the images appeared while people were in a state different from either waking or sleeping, a third state, more like the one prevailing in the supersensible world. Human beings lived with the dead in spirit far more than is possible nowadays. There is no need to look back many centuries before the Christian era to realize that countless numbers of people were then able to say, quote, "The dead are certainly not dead. They are living in the supersensible world. I can perceive what they are feeling and seeing, what they now actually are. This holds good also for other beings in the supersensible world, those, for instance, whom we know as the hierarchies." Close quote. Thus, for human beings in certain states between waking and sleeping, these were experiences of which only the last degenerate echoes linger on in dreams. Hence it was very significant for people to feel this disappearance of something they once possessed. In that transitional epoch of human evolution, when the great events were taking place in Palestine, there was indeed cause for saying, quote, "Change your mood of soul. Quite different times are coming for mankind," close quote. And among the changes was this, that the old possibility of seeing into the spiritual world, of personally experiencing how matters stood with the dead and with all other spiritual beings, was going to pass away. The history of those olden days offers ample evidence of this living with the dead, notably in the religious veneration arising everywhere in the form of ancestor worship. This was founded on belief in the reality and activity of those who had died, and whereas it continued almost everywhere, during the transitional period, people's experience was this, though perhaps not put clearly into words. Quote, "Formerly our souls could rise to the world we call that of the spirit, and we were able to dwell among higher beings and with the dead. But now our dead leave us in quite another sense. They disappear from our consciousness, and the old vivid contact is no more." Close quote. We come here to something exceptionally difficult to grasp, but the intelligent mind, the intelligent soul, can learn to do so. It was the early Christians who felt most vividly the loss of direct psychic contact with the dead, and it was this that made their worship of God so full of meaning, so infinitely deep and holy. They compensated for what was lost by the reverent feeling they brought to their religious ceremonies. When, for instance, they sacrificed at the graves of their dead, or celebrated the Mass, or observed any other religious rite. In fact, it was during this period of transition, when consciousness of the dead was seen to be waning, that altars took the shape of coffins. Thus it was with this kind of feeling for human mortal remains, different from that of the ancient Egyptians, that the service of God, the service of the Spirit, was reverently performed. As I have said, this is something not easy to understand. We need, however, only observe the form of an altar, to allow our hearts to respond to this gradual change in man's whole outlook and feeling, and understanding will then arise for the change and its consequences. We see, therefore, that slowly, gradually, the present state of the human soul came about. From indications given yesterday, it can be gathered that what has thus come into being will again be succeeded by a different state, for which people are already developing faculties. The example I gave you yesterday of how a person will see, in a kind of dream picture, his future karmic compensation for some deed, means the reawakening of faculties that will lead the soul once more to spiritual worlds. In relation to earthly evolution as a whole, the intermediate state, when the soul is cut off from the supersensible world, will prove to be comparatively short. It had to come about for man to be able to acquire the strongest possible forces for his freedom. But something else of which I have spoken was bound up with the whole progress of human evolution, that only in this way were people able to acquire a feeling of the ego within them, to have, that is, the right ego consciousness. The farther we advance into the future, the more firmly will this ego consciousness establish itself within us, continually increasing in significance. In other words, the force and self-sufficiency of human individuality will be increasingly accentuated, so that it becomes necessary for people to find in themselves their own means of support and self-reliance. Thus we see that the ego consciousness people have today does not go back as far as is usually imagined. Only a few incarnations ago, people had no ego feeling, such as is characteristic of them today. And as the ego feeling is intimately connected with memory, we need not be surprised that many people should not have begun as yet to look back on their previous incarnations. Because of the undeveloped state of this feeling for their ego during early childhood, people do not even remember what happened to them then. So it seems quite understandable that for the same reasons, they are as yet unable to remember their earlier incarnations. But now we have come to the point when man has developed a feeling for his ego, and the forces are unfolding which will make it necessary in our coming incarnations to remember those who have gone before. The days are drawing near when people will feel bound to admit, quote, "We have strange glimpses into the past, when we were on the earth before, but living in another bodily form. We look back and have to say that we have already been on earth." Close quote. And among the faculties appearing more and more in human beings will be one which arouses the feeling of looking back to one's own earlier incarnations. Just think how, in human souls now on earth, the inner force is already arising which will enable them in their next incarnations to look back and to recognize themselves. But for those who have not become familiar with the idea of reincarnation, this looking back will be a veritable torment. Ignorance of the mysteries of repeated earthly lives will be actually painful for these human beings. Forces in them are striving to rise and bear witness to earlier times, but this cannot happen because all knowledge of these forces is rejected. Not to learn of the truths now being advanced by spiritual science does not just mean neglecting mere theories, but means preparing a torment for oneself in future incarnations. In these times of transition, accordingly, something is happening. The slow preparation for it can also be gathered from our second mystery play titled The Soul's Probation, where the characters' former incarnations are portrayed. incarnations that occurred just a few centuries earlier. This preparation is already taking place. And now, thanks to the wisdom of cosmic guidance, human beings will be given positive opportunities for making themselves familiar with the truths of the mysteries. At present, comparatively few people find their way to spiritual science. Their number is modest compared with that of the rest of mankind. It may be said that interest in anthroposophy is not yet very widespread. But in our age, the law of reincarnation is such that those now going through the world apathetically, ignoring what experience can tell about the need for exploring the riddles of life, will incarnate again in a relatively short time, and thus have ample opportunity then for absorbing the truths of spiritual science. That is how things stand. So that when, perhaps, we see around us people we esteem, people we love, who will have nothing to do with anthroposophy, are even hostile toward it, we ought not to take it too much to heart. It is perfectly true, and should be realized by anthroposophists, that refusing to examine spiritual science or anthroposophy means preparing a life of torment for future incarnations on earth. That is true, and should not be treated lightly. On the other hand, those who see friends and acquaintances they care for showing no inclination toward anthroposophy can say, quote, "If I become a good anthroposophist myself, I shall find an early opportunity, with the forces remaining to me after death, to prove helpful to these souls." Close quote. Provided the living link we have spoken of exists. And because the interval between death and rebirth is becoming shorter, these souls too will have the opportunity of absorbing the mystery truths that must be absorbed if torment is to be avoided in people's coming incarnations. All is not yet lost. We have, therefore, to look upon anthroposophy as a real power, but on the other hand must not be unduly grieved or pessimistic about the matter. It would be mistaken optimism to say, quote, "If that is how things are, I need not accept the truths of spiritual science till my next incarnation." Close quote. If everyone were to say that, there would be too few opportunities for effective aid to be given through subsequent incarnations. Even if those wishing for anthroposophy can now receive its truths from a few people only, the situation will be different for the countless hosts of those who, in a comparatively short time, will be eagerly turning to anthroposophy. A countless number of anthroposophists will then be needed to make these truths known, either here on the physical plane, or if they are not incarnated, from higher planes. That is one thing we must learn from the whole character of the great change now taking place. The other is that all this has to be experienced by the ego so that it should rely increasingly upon itself, becoming more and more independent. The self-reliance of the ego must come for all souls, but it will mean disaster for those who make no effort to learn about the great spiritual truths, for increasing individualism will be felt by them as isolation. On the other hand, those who have made themselves familiar with the deep mysteries of the spiritual world will thereby find a way to forge ever stronger spiritual bonds between souls. Old bonds will be loosened, new ones formed. All this is imminent, but it will only gradually come about. We are living at present in the fifth post-Atlantean period, which will be followed by a sixth and then by a seventh, when a catastrophe will come upon us, just as one came between the Atlantean and post-Atlantean periods. When I gave lectures on the apocalypse here in Nuremberg, you heard a description of this coming catastrophe, of how it will resemble and how differ from the one in old Atlantis. If we observe life around us, we might express the particular feature of our age in the following way. The most active element in human beings today is their intellectualism, their intellectual conception of the world. We are living altogether in an age of intellectualism. It has been brought about through quite special circumstances, and we shall come to understand these if we look back to the time before our present fifth post-Atlantean cultural epoch, the Greco-Roman, as it is called. That was a remarkable period when human beings had not reached their present state of detachment from natural phenomena and their knowledge of the world. But, at the same time, it was the epoch in which the ego dawned. The Christ event had also to happen in that epoch, because it was then that the ego dawned in a special way. What then is our present experience? It is not just of the ego's dawning. We now experience how one of our bodily sheaths casts a kind of reflection upon the soul. The sheath to which we yesterday gave the name of faith body casts its reflection onto the human soul in this fifth epoch. Thus it is a feature of present-day man that he has something in his soul which is, as it were, a reflection of the astral body's faith nature. In the sixth post-Atlantean epoch, there will be a reflection within man of the love nature of the etheric body. And in the seventh, before the great catastrophe, the reflection of the hope nature of the physical body. For those who have heard lectures I have recently been giving in various places, I would note that these gradual developments have been described from a different point of view, both in Munich and in Stuttgart. The theme, however, is always the same. What I am now describing, in connection with the three great human forces, faith, love, hope, was there represented in direct relation to the elements in a person's soul life, but it is all the same thing. I have done this intentionally, so that anthroposophists may grow accustomed to get the gist of a matter without strict adherence to particular words. When we realize that things can be described from many different angles, we shall no longer pin so much faith on specific words, but focus our efforts on the matter itself, knowing that any description amounts only to an approximation of the truth. This insistence on someone's original words is the last thing that can help us get to the heart of a matter. The one helpful means is to harmonize what has been said in successive lectures, just as we learn about a tree by studying it not from one direction only, but from many different aspects. At present, then, it is essentially the force of faith of the astral body, which, shining into the soul, is characteristic of our time. Someone might say, well, that is rather strange. You are telling us now that the ruling force of the age is faith. We might admit this is the case for those who hold to old beliefs, but today so many people are too mature for that, and they look down on such old beliefs as belonging to the childish stage of human evolution. Close quote. It may well be that people who say they are monists believe they do not believe, but actually they are more ready to do so than those calling themselves believers. For though monists are not conscious of it, all that we see in the various forms of monism is belief of the blindest kind, believed by the monists to be knowledge. We cannot describe their doings at all without mentioning belief. And apart from the belief of those who believe they do not believe, we find that, strictly speaking, an endless amount of what is most important today depends upon the reflection the astral body throws into the soul, thereby giving it the character of ardent faith. We have only to call to mind lives of the great figures of our age, Richard Wagner's, for example, and how even as an artist he was aspiring all his life to a certain intensity of faith. It is fascinating to watch this in the development of his personality. Everywhere we look today, the light and shadow of our time can be interpreted as the reflection of faith in what we may call man's ego soul. Our age will be followed by one upon which the need for love will cast its light. What can also be called Christian love will manifest in a very different form in the sixth cultural epoch. Slowly, we draw nearer to that epoch, and by making those in the anthroposophical movement familiar with the mysteries of the cosmos, with the nature of various individualities, both on the physical plane and on the higher planes, we try to kindle love for everything that exists. This is not done so much by talking of love as by feeling what can kindle love in the soul. Thus we prepare for the sixth epoch by means of anthroposophy. Through anthroposophy, the forces of love are specially aroused in the whole human soul. And what we need for gradually acquiring a true understanding of the mystery of Golgotha is prepared. For although the mystery of Golgotha came to pass, and although the Gospels have evoked something which yesterday was likened to how children learn to speak, the deepest lesson, the mission of earthly love in its connection with the mystery of Golgotha, has not yet been grasped. Full understanding of this will be possible only in the sixth post-Atlantean cultural epoch. When people grow to realize more and more that the foundations for it are actually within them, and out of their innermost being, in other words, out of love, do what should be done. Then the guidance of the commandments will have been outlived, and the stage reached that is described in Goethe's words, quote, "Duty is when one loves the commands one gives to oneself," close quote. When forces waken in our souls, which impel us to do what we should through love alone, we then discover in ourselves something that must gradually become widespread in the sixth cultural epoch. Then quite special forces of the etheric body too will make themselves known to humankind. To understand what will increasingly come about in this way, we have to consider it from two angles. One aspect is related to something that has certainly not come yet, and is only dreamt of by the most advanced in spirit, a quite particular relationship to morals, ethics, and the understanding intellectuality. Today a person may be quite a rascal, yet at the same time intelligent and clever. He may even use his very cleverness to further his knavery. People do not yet have to combine their intelligence with an equal degree of morality. To all that we have been anticipating for the future, this must be added, that as we advance, it will no longer be possible for these two qualities of the human soul to be kept apart or to exist in unequal measure. A person who, according to the reckoning of his previous incarnation, has become particularly intelligent without being moral, will in his new incarnation possess only a stunted intelligence. Thus, to have equal amounts of intelligence and morality in future incarnations, he will be obliged, as a consequence of universal cosmic law, to enter his new incarnation with an intelligence that is crippled, so that immorality and stupidity coincide. For immorality has a crippling effect upon intelligence. In other words, we are approaching the age when morality and what has now been described for the sixth post-Atlantean epoch as the etheric body's love forces shining into the ego soul point essentially to the harmonizing of intelligence and morality. That is the one aspect to be considered. The other aspect is this, that it is solely through harmony of this kind, between morality and intelligence, that the whole depth of the mystery of Golgotha is to be grasped. This will come about through the individuality who before Christ Jesus came to earth prepared man for that mystery. and in his successive incarnations he will develop ever greater powers as teacher of the greatest of all earthly events. This individuality, whom in his rank as Bodhisattva we call the successor of Gautama Buddha, was incarnated in the individual living about 100 years before Christ, under the name of Jeshu ben Pandira. Among his many students was one who had, at that time, already in a certain sense, written down a prophetic version of the Matthew Gospel. And this, after the mystery of Golgotha had been fulfilled, needed only to be given a new form. There have been and will continue to be frequent incarnations of the individuality who appeared as Jeshu ben Pandira, until he rises from the rank of Bodhisattva to that of Buddha. According to our reckoning of time, this will be in about 3,000 years, when a sufficient number of people will possess the faculties we have spoken of, and when, in the course of a remarkable incarnation of the individual who was once Jeshu ben Pandira, this great teacher of mankind will have been able to act as interpreter of the mystery of Golgotha in a very different way from what is possible today. It is true that even today a seer into the supersensible worlds can gain some idea of what is to happen then. But the ordinary earthly organization of man cannot yet provide a physical body capable of doing what that teacher will be able to do approximately 3,000 years hence. There is, as yet, no human language through which verbal teaching could exert the magical effects that will spring from the words of that great teacher of humanity. His words will flow directly to human hearts, into their souls, like a healing medicine. Nothing in those words will be merely theoretical. At the same time, the teaching will contain, to an extent far greater than it is possible to conceive today, a magical moral force, carrying to hearts and souls a full conviction of the eternal, deeply significant brotherhood of intellect and morality. This great teacher, who will be able to give to a mankind that is ripe for it the profoundest instruction on the nature of the mystery of Golgotha, will fulfill what Oriental prophets have always said, that the true successor of Buddha would be the greatest teacher of the good for all mankind. For that reason he has been called in Oriental tradition the Maitreya Buddha. His task will be to enlighten human beings about the mystery of Golgotha. And for this he will draw ideas and words of the deepest significance from the very language he will use. No human language today can evoke any conception of it. His words will directly, magically, imprint into human souls the nature of the mystery of Golgotha. So, in this way, too, we are approaching what we may call the future moral age of man. In a certain sense, we could describe it as a coming golden age. Even today, however, when we speak out of anthroposophy, we point in full consciousness to what is destined to come about, how the Christ will gradually reveal himself to ever higher powers in human beings, and how the teachers who up to now have taught only particular peoples and individuals will become interpreters of the great Christ event for all who are willing to listen. And we can point out how the dawning of the age of love also provides conditions needed for this age of morality. Then will come the last epoch, during which human souls will receive the reflection of what we call hope, when, strengthened through the force flowing from the mystery of Golgotha and from the age of morality, human beings will take forces of hope into themselves. This is the most important gift they need in order to face the next catastrophe and to begin new life, just as the post-Atlantean age brought new life to birth. When, in the final post-Atlantean epoch, our external culture, with its tendency to logic and calculation, comes to a climax, bringing no feeling of satisfaction, but leaving those who may not have developed the spiritual within them to face their culture in utter desolation, then out of spirituality the seed of hope will be sown. And in the next period of human evolution, this will grow to maturity. If the spirit is denied all possibility of imparting to human souls what it can give and what the anthroposophical movement has the will to convey, this external culture might for a short while be able to hold its own. Ultimately, however, people would ask themselves what they had gained and say, quote, "We have high-tech equipment, undreamt of by our ancestors, to transmit our thoughts all over the earth, yet what good does it do us? The most trivial, unproductive thoughts are sent hither and thither, and human ingenuity has to be strained to the utmost to enable us to transport from some far distant region, by means of all kinds of perfected appliances, something for us to eat, or to travel at high speeds round the globe. But in our heads, there is nothing worth sending from place to place, for our thoughts are cheerless. Moreover, since we have had our present means of communication, they have become even more cheerless than when they were conveyed in the old snail-like fashion." Close quote. In short, despair and desolation are all that our external civilization can spread over the earth. But in the last cultural epoch, souls who have taken up the spiritual in life will have become enriched, though standing amongst the ruins of external cultural life. Their surety that this acceptance of the spiritual has not been in vain will be the strong force of hope within them, hope that after a great catastrophe a new age will come for human beings, when there will appear in external life, in a new culture, what has already been prepared spiritually within the soul. Thus, if we permeate our whole being with spiritual science, we advance step by step, in full consciousness, from our age of faith, through the age of love, and that of hope, to what we can see approaching us as the highest, truest, most beautiful goals of humanity. The end of Lecture 12.